Turn in your Bibles to the 115th Psalm. We'll read the first 8 verses. Psalm 115. Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but unto thy name give glory, for thy mercy and for thy truth's sake. Wherefore should the heathen say, Where is now their God? But our God is in the heavens. He hath done whatsoever he hath pleased. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. Noses have they, but they smell not. They have hands, but they handle not. Feet have they, but they walk not. Neither speak they through the throat. They that make them are like unto them. So is everyone that trusteth in them. The last time we turned to this psalm, we noticed the contrast the psalmist is making between the God of Israel and all of the idols and false gods of mankind. And we noted how God spoke. He has spoken, and still he speaks. This time I would like for us to notice the next phrase in this series of comparing God, the idols with God. Mouths. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes have they, but they see not. Ears have they, but they hear not. Eyes have they, but they see not. Ears have they, but they hear not. Our God is a God who sees all, he hears all, he knows all. Now, to us today, that would seem like obvious that an idol is nothing, as Paul put it, and that our God has all the attributes that we attribute to him. But in the day of the psalmist, that was not the case because Israel was the only people on the face of the earth that understood that, and not all of them did. And there are people on this world today who worship idols. You can go down East 14th Street and you can see a temple to some of the idols of this world. But for anyone who is at all a theist, who is not an agnostic or an atheist or a pagan, it would seem like a tautology, like belaboring the obvious, to say that God, though he has no eyes, like no material eyes like ours, he sees all. And that though he has no material ears like ours, he hears all. And that is the contrast that the psalmist is making here. But he's making a much more of a contrast than just that. For like all words in every language, words have different meanings depending on how they're used and the context. And the word to say that God sees all is not just to emphasize that he has a gift, the attribute of vision or the faculty of vision, And to say that he hears is not just to say that he has the faculty of hearing, for, as I said, words mean sometimes more than we accept them at on face value. To see often means to perceive, to understand. And to hear often means to heed and to give a hearing to. And this is the sense in which we say God sees and he knows. He sees and he perceives and knows what's going on. He hears and he heeds. He gives audience. If a court would agree to hear a matter that you have, and they would give you a hearing, that means that they would give you a chance, an opportunity to voice what is your complaint. They would take it under advisement, and they would determine if it should be acted upon or not. This is the sense in which God sees and God hears. And one of the most lovely titles of God, one of the most lovely descriptions of him, we find in the 65th Psalm, the first two verses. Praise waiteth for thee, O God, in Zion, and unto thee shall the vow be performed, O thou that hearest prayer. Unto thee shall all flesh come, O thou that hearest prayer. Isn't that a lovely phrase? Isn't that an assuring and comforting truth? And not just that God hears what we're saying, but he gives us a hearing, and he heeds, and he always answers our prayers. I remember the first time I ever heard that stated that way. Brother Jesse Franklin says, God has always answered every prayer I have ever made. And I opened my eyes and my ears and I sat up. I want to know how this happens. And he says, but sometimes he says no. And no is an answer. So God does hear us. He does see us. He understands our predicaments. He hears our prayers, and he heeds when we pray. And that should be an incentive for us to do more praying. O thou that hearest prayer and sees our situations, our predicaments. Let us see how scriptural that is. Turning to the third chapter of the Exodus. You remember how God sent a famine in the land of Canaan? He had previously sent Joseph as a slave into Egypt. A tragedy. And why would God deliberately send Joseph into slavery? With the hindsight of so many centuries and the Word of God, we understand why. But he must have thought hard about that. And gradually his people were enslaved in Egypt. And now God was going to deliver them. And in the third chapter of Exodus, we read, "Now Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the backside of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in the flame of the fire out of the midst of the bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush is not burnt. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called unto him out of the midst of the bush and said unto him, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here am I. And he says, Draw not nigh hither. Put off the shoes from thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said unto him, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. Oh, you do now. Where have you been? It was 400 years from the time of Abraham to the time of Moses. And the time, the rest of Abraham's life, and the life of Isaac, and the life, most of the life of Jacob, and the life of Jacob and Joseph. They lived either in the land of Canaan, or they lived comfortably in Egypt. Scholars who study these things by various methods have come to the conclusion that it was about 200 years that they were actually in slavery. That's a long time. 200 years. For 200 years, where have you been, God? For 200 years, we've been crying to you. Did you not know we're here? He says, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. And I am come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians. So God permitted not only Joseph to be enslaved, but all of his people. How could a good God, if he loved his people, let them be enslaved for 200 years? Haven't you had people say similar things to you? How would a good God let all the heathen die and go to hell? How would a loving God let all the children of the world suffer what they have nothing to do with? Of course, we know from the perspective of history, and perhaps from our own experience, that God does have purposes that he doesn't tell us about. Some of them he may tell us about them later. Some of them we may figure out later. Why would God let Israel be enslaved? Well, let's look at the record. I'm sure you're all of you familiar with the record in Genesis. Brother Crook has been dealing on this subject of late. God spoke to Abram and told him to leave his homeland and to go to him to a place that he would show him. And he ended up in the land of Canaan. And there, after many years, Isaac was born to him. and Jacob to Isaac and Rebekah, and 12 sons and daughters to Jacob. And they lived a rather comfortable nomadic life in the land of Canaan. There's fine pastures there, and they found water. And it was more of a pasture land then than it was later on and is today. But as so often happens when God's people are living comfortably, now see if we have a modern parallel to this in our own country. They began to live like Canaanites. That was not what God had in mind. If you want to know how they were living like Canaanites, you can turn to the 34th chapter of Genesis, and you can turn to the 38th chapter of Genesis, and you could see the sordid tales of how they began to live like Canaanites. God doesn't let his people get away with anything. He did not have in mind for them to settle down and live like Canaanites in that promised land. So he arranged, and he did arrange, to have Joseph sold into slavery and go to Egypt, and for a famine to come to drive the family into Egypt. Joseph himself figured out why that was, and he told them later, God arranged for me to be able to save our people. So they lived in comfort in Egypt, and they settled down to the good life. And they began to live like Egyptians. And they found the leeks and the onions and the melons and the garlic of Egypt quite a good diet. They found the ways of Egypt to be pleasing. The climate was warm. The river water was plentiful. The pasture was good. And they began to live like Egyptians. So God says, well, if they won't be a people apart, I will make them a people apart, and he enslaved them, so that they became loathed by the Egyptians. That's a good way to say apart, when people loathe you. And thus God made them a people apart. And the Egyptians enslaved them and persecuted them. That's the reason why the Jews have been so persecuted over these centuries, because they are different. Have you ever noticed people don't like people who are different? And so if people don't like you as a Christian, why, you know why. But anyway, God had his reasons for waiting, and he delivered them. And he showed them that he champions the cause of the persecuted. What about the people in China that are persecuted? Is God championing their cause, the Christians there? I read an article once written by a missionary who had been in China and was keeping up with things there. And he said that one of the Chinese high in the Chinese bureaucracy was approached by a Christian one day, a foreign Christian, and says, why do you persecute the Christians in China when you yourself acknowledge that they are model citizens? And this man replied, because Christians are supposed to be persecuted. That's how they grow. And they are growing in China because of persecution. There is a lesson here for all of us to learn. God is not careful for our comfort, but he is most careful for our good. Remember that the next time you come to the end of yourself. But the prophet Isaiah got a vision behind the scenes. He was let in on some of the secrets of God's dealings with his people. And in the 63rd chapter of Isaiah, and in verse 9, we read, "In all their afflictions, he was afflicted. The angel of his presence saved them." Did you ever stop to think when you hurt, God's hurts? In all their afflictions, he was afflicted. And that was contrary to all heathen thought and teachings of the day. The Greeks developed the heathen thought to a very fine philosophy that God is so perfect and so one in his unity that he is impassible. That is, he does not, cannot feel pain or sorrow, sadness of any kind, because he's perfect. That's not the God of the Bible. In all their afflictions, he was afflicted. God did see and take note. God did hear and deliver them. But God is also the God of the disadvantaged. Turn with me to the 16th chapter of Genesis, and here is another very familiar story, and we've heard about it recently. The 16th chapter of Genesis regarding Hagar and Sarah and Ishmael and Isaac. You know the story, how Abraham and Sarah were unable to have a child. They were very aged. The angel of the Lord visited them, and they in their old age had a child, Isaac. And Isaac and his wife Rebekah had Jacob and Esau. But in the meantime, when they could not have a child, Sarah concocted an idea. "I have a slave girl here." And according to the custom of the time, it was perfectly legitimate. "Abraham, you take her for a second wife, and her son will be mine and yours." Has that ever worked out? And according to the custom and laws of the time, she was a legitimate wife of Abraham. I've heard it said, and I've observed it's true, there is no house large enough for two women. And it wasn't so in this case. And Sarah treated Hagar mean. Sarah brought it on herself, but she took out her spite on Hagar. So Hagar took all she could, and so she ran away. And the angel of the Lord found her by a fountain in the 16th chapter of Genesis, the 7th verse. By a fountain of water in the wilderness, by the fountain of the way of Shur. And he said, "Hagar, Sarah's maid, whence camest thou?" As though he didn't know. "And whither wilt thou go?" And she said, "I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai." And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Return to thy mistress and submit thyself under her hands. Huh? Go back into the fire? It ain't fair. And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarah. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Return to thy mistress and submit thyself under her hands. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and shall bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And so it is even to this day in his descendants. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And she called the name of the Lord that spoke unto her, Thou, God, seest me. God spoke to her. He saw her. He understood her position. But go on back to Sarah, sir. Go on back to where you're being persecuted. So turning over to the 21st chapter of Genesis. In 21 and 17. So it got to the point where it couldn't go on any longer. And finally, Sarah said, Abraham, get that woman out of here. And God agreed with her. So Abraham dismissed her. And she again went out into the wilderness to the south. In verse 16, she went and sat her down over against. Oh, let's go back to the 12th verse where God spoke to her. And God said into Abraham, God said, Let it not be grievous in thy sight because of the lad, because of the bondwoman. In all that Sarah hath said unto thee, hearken unto her voice, for in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And also the son of the bondwoman will I make a nation, because he is thy seed. And Abram rose up early in the morning, and took bread and a bottle of water, and gave it unto Hagar, putting it on her shoulder. And the child, who was about 14 or 15 at the time, and sent her away, and she departed and wandered in the wilderness of Beersheba. And the water was spent in the bottle, and she cast the child under one of the shrubs, and she went and sat her down over against him a good way off, as it were a bow shot, for she said, Let me not see the death of the child. And she sat over against him and lifted up her voice and wept. And God heard Hagar's voice. God heard the voice of the lad. And the angel of God called to Hagar out of heaven and said unto her, What aileth thee, Hagar? As if he didn't know. Fear not, for God hath heard the voice of the lad where he is. Arise, lift up the lad and hold him in thine hand, for I will make him a great nation. And God opened her eyes, and she saw a well of water. And she went and filled the bottle with water and gave the lad drink. And God was with the lad, and he grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. Now consider this. Hagar was a slave, probably gotten by Sarah when they were in Egypt, because Hagar was an Egyptian. She was in a foreign country. She probably learned some of the language of Abraham and Sarah, but it was a foreign language to her, the language of Canaan. It was not her idea to have Ishmael by Abraham. And it was not her idea to be kicked out in the end. She was used, she was abused, and she was rejected. But God took her as his own personal responsibility. God is the champion of the disadvantaged. Is that so today? In this metropolitan area where we are, there are thousands of people who are disadvantaged due to no fault of their own. There are some of them due to their own fault, but there are many due to no fault of their own. We need to think about that. God is the champion of the disadvantaged. So should we be. So God sees and hears the persecuted. He sees and hears the disadvantaged. But what about the ordinary person? What about you? Does God see in the sense of understanding you? Does he hear in the sense of giving audience to your prayers? Let's see what David has to say about that in the 34th Psalm. In the 34th Psalm, in the 4th verse, we'll read from the first. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make her boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear thereof and be glad. Oh, magnify the Lord with me. Let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he heard me, and delivered me from all my fears. His fears. This is a psalm of David. It was a psalm when he was rejected, when he was living in a Philistine city, when Saul was seeking his life. I sought the Lord, and he heard me and delivered me from all my fears. Do you have troubles like David had troubles? Do you have fears? You know, most of our fears don't materialize. But they're very real. God sees individual persons in their own situation, their troubles, and their fears. And he does deliver. We need to remember this because we all of us know what this is like. We all of us have experienced it, and we all will experience it again. He will hear us. He will deliver us from our troubles. He will deliver us from our fears, even if it takes him 200 years to do it. But God doesn't always hear us. He doesn't always answer. In the 10th chapter of Daniel, we read, God had given Daniel some wonderful revelations of his dealings with his people in the future. But with Daniel, what about now? Jeremiah's 70 years have passed. Nothing has really changed. So Daniel set himself in prayer to find from the Lord answers to his puzzles. In the 12th verse, then he, the man whom he saw in the vision, a glorious vision of the pre-incarnate Son of God, then he said unto me, fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that thou didst set thine heart to understand and to chasten thyself before thy God, thy words were heard, and I am come for thy words. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me, and one and twenty days. And lo, Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the king of Persia. Now we are not to suppose that Satan was so strong that Christ could not have crushed him. He's speaking to Daniel in terms human people can understand. Daniel, I had things to do, and I have a timetable for doing them. And he did come, and he revealed to Daniel his prayer. But for 21 days, God was silent. Perhaps you've had petitions before the Lord for 21 years, and he hasn't answered. Doesn't mean that he hasn't heard. Doesn't mean that he doesn't see and understand. But it means we live within his program, within his plan. A delayed prayer is not an unanswered prayer. And why? He's not obliged to tell us why. We are obliged to trust him. Always remember, when you don't understand God's ways, trust his heart. For in all your afflictions, he himself is afflicted. He does see and understand. He does hear and care. So this brings us to our last point. Let us take advantage of his invitation. In the 4th chapter of the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 4:16, beginning with 15, for we have not an high priest which cannot be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, but was in all points tested like as we are, yet without sin. Let us therefore come boldly unto the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Come to God with our questions. He's the one with the answers. Come to God with our needs. He has invited us to. Come to God with whatever troubles us. He will listen. Do you know that the Lord will listen to you as long as you want to pray? He both sees and hears and will answer.